Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. And first off, some news. This series has been selected as one of the 5 finalists for the DSTV Content Creators Podcast of the Year Awards, which is taking place on October 12th. Finalists there include the hugely successful series called True Crime South Africa, presented by the glorious Nicole Engelbrecht, and the other is African Story Magic with magnificent Tina Mhlophe. So I'm very honored to be selected to be part of the finalists of the year. There are a couple of other finalists, and I'm not expecting much, I must be honest, given the competition. So thanks to all of you, my listeners, for helping promote this podcast series. I owe all of you a great deal. With that shameless self-promotion out of the way, back to the real world of South Africa mid-19th century, momentous moves were afoot. The vicious Eighth Frontier War was bubbling away in the Eastern Cape as Andries Stockenstroom set off from his fabulous farm under the Amatolas. The old man of the frontier had decided to travel to London to lobby politicians there and the ruling elite. He wanted to convince them that self-government was needed for South Africa. Journalist John Fairbairn joined him in the mission. For the settlers back on the frontier, Stockenstroom was both loved and hated. He was respected as an elder who had survived basically all the frontier wars, but now colonists were taking aim at the old man. Virtually every farm had been burned down by the Amaxhosa in the districts, but they'd left Stockenstroom's home alone. The Rarabi people had faithfully adhered to old Chief Nika's promise to Stockenstroom he would not be attacked, even in the throes of this dreadful Eighth Frontier War. Stockenstroom had set off at the end of 1851 for his trip to England. When he returned from his political mission, he was greeted by a smouldering wreck that used to be his magnificent home called Maastrom. It was a shock from which he did not recover. At first, he thought it was the Xhosa who burned down his home, but then the truth emerged, which shocked him all the more. His farm was deliberately burned down by a British officer and his patrol, who had been instigated by Grahamstown Journal editor Robert Godlinton. The editor had written about Stockenstroom's home escaping damage, implying that the old man of the VOC was colluding with Amaxhosa. Godlinton had raged in one of his editorials about Stockenstroom's home resplendent in the hills like a gem in the desert. That wasn't quite true. A few other Boer homes around Maastrom were also untouched on the orders of Amanlika Chief Sandile, but Godlinton hated Stockenstroom. This burning was a symbolic act, and in many ways set up the next century and a half. Here lay the learned man's library in ashes, burned out by men who preferred to destroy thoughts on paper. A reprisal, a mental torture against white men they believed were colluding with black men. You can see how this act is so embryonic, in its futility so gratuitous, and its character not only malicious, but sinister. In the end, the other Boer homes in the vicinity survived. Only Andries Stockenstroom's Maastrom was flattened. Instead of seeking compensation from the British, the old man focused on his push for his people to have representative government in the Cape Colony. "What have I got by these wars?" he said bitterly before the Legislative Council later. "My property in ruins, part of my family living in wrecked sheds, my home burnt down, not by the black man, but by the white man." Instead of becoming self-destructive, drinking or destroying himself, he wrote letters by the dozen to British officials, calling on them to investigate the start of the Cut River Rebellion to seek out the real causes of the Eighth Frontier War. And we know what they were. Harry Smith had set off this war by trying to eradicate Amaxhosa power bases, the chiefs, their traditions, trying to destroy Amaxhosa culture. And here was Stockenstroom, aware of Smith's culpability, trying to convince the powers that be to scrutinize the war hero's catastrophic edicts. Godlinton and his supporters opposed the idea of an inquiry, fighting it tooth and nail, even in the midst of this terrible war. that Smith had triggered. To the north, in the mountains along the Caledon Valley, Moshoeshoe had been building his base of power and was trying to keep out of the British way. Local representative Major Warden, as you know, was based in Bloemfontein with a company of British troops, and the Major had been skirmishing with Moshoeshoe and his allies along the southern flank of the Orange River, the border with British Kaffraria. We heard in episode 161 about the June 1851 incident where Warden had been chased away from the Platberg area by Moshoeshoe's son Morapo and half-brother Mopele. This was in response to Warden's ultimatum to hand over 6,000 cattle and 300 horses in compensation for the damages inflicted on other communities by the Basutu. By other communities, he meant Moshoeshoe's Basutu arch-enemy, Sikonyela. When Warden ordered a peremptory attack on Moletsane's Taung on the 4-foot mountain between Platberg and Mokwatleng, they managed to capture 3,000 cattle, but Morapo and Mopere drove them off, killing 200 of the Rolong who were fighting alongside the British. Warden retreated to Dabanchu with the other survivors. His grand campaign in tatters and his attempts at pacifying Moshoeshoe failed. The slump in prestige led to whites of all kinds seeking the ear of the Mosutu king, all shades of opinion from all over the Orange River and both sides of the Vaal River pitched up to schmooze Moshoeshoe. British loyalists and republicans like Boer leader Andries Pretorius and a man called Adriaan van der Kolff. South African history is awash with people like van der Kolff, but before we dive into his gene pool, let's take a quick broad look at what was going on between the Boers and the Basutu. While the British were being kept busy in the 8th Frontier War, Andries Pretorius had been in touch with Major Warden and with Moshoeshoe. Emissaries from Moshoeshoe had visited Pretorius a few times to ask for the Boers to join the Basutu in an uprising against the British, particularly after Warden's repeated attempts to subjugate the Basutu king. Moshoeshoe had a good understanding of military strategy and told Pretorius that he could raise a few thousand warriors, then attack the British in Natal if Pretorius wanted it. He knew how the British annexation of Natal had rankled the Boers, how they had fought a mini-war over the Greenlands of Natal and tried to induce Pretorius into fighting their European foe. Pretorius balked at the suggestion. Some bizarre reports began to emerge that Mzilikazi of the Amandebele, who was now living in what would become Western Zimbabwe around Bulawayo, was also making overtures to the Boers about joining such an attack. Pretorius was horrified. Mzilikazi's warriors had killed dozens of his people along the Vaal River in the early 1830s. He would also not consider fighting alongside a black king when it came to the Boers' military campaigns against the English. But it goes to show you how quickly political strategy changed on South Africa's territory. By mid-1851, the Boers had begun to pressurize Pretorius to take up the position of Administrator General of the ravaged Trans-Oranje region, known as the Orange River Sovereignty. The British controlled this, and the Boer Volksraad was saying that needed to be taken back to restore peace. The Kora, the Krikwa, the Korana, the Rolong, the Basutu, the British and the Boers were all contesting this place. It was time to stabilize things, thought 137 Boer men who signed a petition calling on Pretorius to take over. The political campaign gained impetus, and soon King Moshoeshoe heard about it and lent his support to the plan. By early September, the Boers' war cabinet decreed that Pretorius should travel to the Orange River sovereignty and impose his will on the folks who were believed to be indulging in raids and chaos. The extent to which Moshoeshoe was willing to agree on the exact borders of the land in question is debatable, but it is true that the Basutu king was deploying his usual tact and political strategy here. Pretorius wrote a letter to Warden explaining that the Boers from Witbergen and the Sant Rivier wanted him to negotiate a settlement on behalf of all the people of the Orange River. He also said that Moshoeshoe had asked him to act as a mediator between the British and the Basutu. This was also true, although Pretorius exaggerated his relationship with the Basutu king, recognizing that offering to help would improve his relations with the British. Major Warden was nervous. He distrusted Pretorius and all Boers, to be quite honest. rumours had swirled, as rumours do, that Pretorius was actually planning a big commando raid on the British HQ in Bloemfontein. A Scots missionary, Reverend Andrew Murray, was on alert in the north, ensuring that Pretorius stayed on his side of the Vaal River, keeping an eye on things. Messengers galloped off to the town of Vinburg and told the British commander there, Captain Parrish, to round up all the families who'd brought land in the area and proceed to the Queen's fort with their livestock. While that was going on, a separate group of Boers decided to take the matter into their own hands and rode to Tababusu, where they negotiated their own peace treaty with Moshweshwe. They didn't tell Pretorius, and he was angry. Once again, the fractured nature of the Voortrekkers was highlighted. Moshweshwe knew that too, but took the emissaries at face value when they said they'd avoid conflict with the Basutu and other groups. There was a grey area, however. The Boer peace team said they would only take up arms against anyone in the area in self-defence if their land was under threat. There's been some dispute about exactly what that meant. The group of Boers, led by G.F. Linde and Jan Vermaak, signed the treaty with Moshweshwe and his sons Morapu, Masupa, and Nehemiah on the 3rd of September 1851. After this, the Basutu would differentiate between the Boers who honoured this treaty and the Boers who were sympathetic to the British government. Pretorius was in Mooi Rivier, and he was angry about this matter because he had been trying to stabilise the Trekker relationship with the British himself. Here were Vermaak and Linde doing their own thing, clearly a threat to Major Warden. So the following day, on the 4th of September, Pretorius wrote to Warden expressing a commitment to lasting peace with the British. Political matters were moving ahead at a pace. On the very same day that Pretorius put quill to paper, Scots Reverend Murray arrived in Mooi Rivier. The missionaries were riding around trying to get a fix on what the Boers were actually wanting. Murray parleyed with Pretorius and realised the Boer leader was playing it straight. So Murray told the British they should remove the price on Pretorius's head. He had been sought by the British for their previous skirmishes you've heard about. It was also clear to Pretorius that he couldn't declare himself the administrator of the Orange River sovereignty, and he wrote another letter, this time to his own supporters at Witbergen and Sint Rivier, saying it would be premature to take further action. He could not be the administrator of the Orange River sovereignty. A flurry of letters began to pass back and forth. Pretorius was invited by Moshweshwe to join him, but wrote a letter saying he had to stay away because his horses were sick, sent his son instead. A few days later, Moshweshwe wrote to Major Warden to defend his actions during the previous battle at Vierfoot in June and July. The Basutu king said he had had to fight to protect his own people. It was self-defense. Moshweshwe also promised to deal with the rampant stock theft that was going on and blamed the AmaZulu warriors who were based with the British at Tabanchu. A messy round of letter-writing, incidents, allegations and finger-pointing. In early October 1851, the son of Andries Pretorius, Martinus Pretorius, and Dier Boete arrived in the British town of Bloemfontein to meet with Warden and talk peace. Andries Pretorius was still technically being sought by the British, so young Pretorius was doing the face-to-face meetings with the Lieutenant Governor just in case. The tensions ebbed away and the families cooped up in the Queen's Fort at Vinburg went back to their farms. Colonial Secretary Earl Grey had sent two officials to keep an eye on things. He was extremely dissatisfied with the quality of information flowing to his office from Governor Harry Smith's office, as well as Major Warden's HQ. Assistant Commissioners Captain William Hogg and Charles Mostain Owen rode into Bloemfontein, tasked with putting matters right. Grey was particularly unhappy about reports received from Moshweshwe that contradicted Warden's, that his land was being whittled away by the settlers, and that was the source of the trouble. Hogg and Owen met the Witbergen Boers in late November 1851, who asked that the administrators don't make the Boers across the Vaal River more angry. Hogg and Owen put their heads together to discuss the options. They needed the Boers more than the Boers needed them. Hogg and Owen realised they would have to have the support of the Vaal Boers just in case of military action in the Orange River sovereignty. And of course there was the Eighth Frontier War ongoing. They were also worried about the Basutu. Both soon stumbled on the fact that Major Warden had been selling arms and ammunition to the raiding bands of Griqua and even the Karana, who then used these arms to destabilize the Trans-Orania region by attacking the Basutu. What a messy business. The sale of arms was halted, upsetting the Griqua in particular. I guess you can't make everyone happy all the time. The Boers were still not happy because their stock was being robbed constantly in the Vinberg district. Major Warden then moved his AmaZulu mercenaries, stationed at Tabanshu, to Vinberg, but this, of course, left Mushoeshoe's opponent, Chief Moroka, somewhat exposed. By now, Colonial Secretary Grey was openly accusing Governor Harry Smith, who hadn't been fired yet, of acting rashly and causing trouble with Mushoeshoe. Smith, said Grey, had misled Her Majesty's government into believing that they needed to establish the Orange River sovereignty. It was in the middle of this morass, this matrix of letter-writing, backstabbing, muttering and murmuring of conspiracy-minded people over the Orange River and surrounds, that a man I mentioned earlier made his spectacular entrance. Adriaan van der Kolff. That's Kolff with a K and two Fs. Meneer Kolff was a proficient counterfeiter, what you would call a confidence trickster, a crook, if you prefer. He realized the importance of Andries Pretorius's name and his reputation, so he duly forged Pretorius's signature in a letter that threatened Moshoeshoe's enemy Sikonyela with death and destruction if he continued helping the British against the Basutu king. Then van der Kolff reverted back to himself, and as the man he'd self-designated Moshoeshoe's general, he sent another letter with his own signature to the Boers in the Orange River sovereignty, declaring he'd lead them if Pretorius sold out to the British. There's a court case in South Africa going on now because it's sub judice. All I can say is that a former leader of the MK party claims his signature was forged in a letter of resignation. It appears there's a long history of alleged fraud when it comes to signatures. When it came to Meneer Kolff, however, we can remove the alleged. Historians chuckle about this now, but you can imagine the chaos this naughty forgerer caused. The first thing that happened was that the Volksraad smelt a rat. They had asked Pretorius to negotiate a peace settlement with the British, but hadn't approved anything yet. Major Warden sniffed when he heard of the letter, which of course appeared real at this moment, and complained of Pretorius's dishonourable dealings. Pretorius, meanwhile, appeared to be in the dark about van der Kolff's dirty dealings. He was still hoping that the Volksraad would ratify his peace deal with the British, who were now not so sure that there was a peace deal. You can see how mischievous men like van der Kolff can cause entire nations to go to war. Pretorius attended a meeting in Rustenburg on the 10th of December, but his part-time opponent, Hendrik Potgieter, was absent, along with the entire Lydenburg and Soutpansberg constituencies. Potgieter had a fit when he heard about the possible deal, writing to Veldkommandant Minnar, who was living in the Magaliesberg, opposing Pretorius's approach. How dare Pretorius negotiate with the British and the Basutu on behalf of the Boers. It was a road to ruin, allowing Pretorius the power to communicate with the British. And anyway, Potgieter reminded everyone that it was he, Hendrik, who had concluded a truce with the British in Natal on behalf of the Boers across the country. Pretorius tried to patch things up with grumpy Hendrik, saying he'd take a large retinue back with him when negotiations began with the British proper. But grumpy Hendrik snarked that the British were trying to take over the whole Transvaal. They were just too busy fighting the Amaxhosa to succeed right now. Ah, the wicked empire was after the Transvaal. At this stage, the wicked empire was not, but the Boers truly believed this because of Smith's rash decision to annex the Orange River sovereignty. Just to point out the obvious, this was in the years before the discovery of diamonds and gold, which were going to change everything. In January 1852, the Lydenburg Volksraad met and approved Pretorius's position as negotiator, but reminded everyone that any decision would have to be ratified by the Volksraad. The new boundary, they said, would be the Vaal River and not the 25th parallel, which the British had used to define territory. It also emerged that Adriaan van der Kolff, the forger of note, had actually written that letter of deception, and he fled. Eventually, Pretorius and 15 delegates headed off to negotiate with Warden, Hogg, and Owen. Pretorius knew it was important to include Moshoeshoe, so invited the Basutu leader to the meeting with the assistant commissioners at Santarafuur on the 16th of January 1852. Moshoeshoe thought it advisable for him to send emissaries instead. Then Hoganoan rescinded Smith's proclamation outlawing Pretorius and others, then decided on the meeting for the momentous Santarafuur Convention. This would be on a farm owned by Piet Venter, a few kilometres downstream of the confluence of the Santarafuur and the Kolspruit, halfway between Winburg and today's town of Kroonstad. A buzz went around the voortrekkers, the volksraads, up and down the country. Many boers set off from far-flung places in their wagons, some of these kitted out as mobile winkels or shops. 50 wagons formed a lager at the site of the convention, and Pretorius rode up there on the 15th of January with 300 supporters from across the Vaal. Later that day, another large crowd of boers approached the farm, this time from the Sant River and Witterbagger districts. These faces were glum, because they were hoping for their own recognition which they weren't receiving. The Sand River Convention was dealing with the Transvaal trekkers only. You'd think that our old friend Adriaan van der Kolff, with two F's, would keep a low profile. But no, not him. Hogg then heard, from one of the leaders of the Sant River group, that van der Kolff was nearby, and Hogg said to Pretorius that the Boer should be arrested. Pretorius was in a bit of a spot. He preferred to let bygones be bygones, but Hogg insisted, and Assistant Commissioner Owen then joined Pretorius, just in case he got cold feet, along with two men of the Lancers in full uniform. No sooner had these riders appeared at the Santarafuur lager than the Boers kicked up a fuss, protesting at the appearance of the two soldiers. Owen sent them back to the convention tents, afraid of causing a scene. As Pretorius walked around looking for van der Kolff, the fugitive was handed a horse, and he galloped to freedom. As he galloped away, he turned a few hundred yards up the trail and picked up his musket and pointed it at Pretorius, who shouted at him, "Kom nader om seker te maak!" Come closer to make certain, a kind of laughing in the face of danger comment. Van der Kolff thought better of it and spurred his horse, immediately followed by an angry group of Pretorius' followers who were going to string him up. Luckily for our forgerer-in-chief, van der Kolff, he managed to escape. Because of his relationship with Moshoeshoe, however, the Basutu delegates, watching all of this, were convinced that this maniac van der Kolff had soured relations between the Boers and their king. Pretorius allayed their fears, saying everything had been sorted, the man was a fake. Still, both the Boers and the British kept extra special watch that night in case van der Kolff rode back into the tent camp with his other friends, Korana brigands. Thus, the nature of frontier life in South Africa, where nothing is certain and everything moves fast. So we'll halt, brush down the tired podcast horses. Next episode, I'll deal with two matters. One, the full details of the Sand River Convention, and the other, an embarrassing defeat for the British at the hands of the Basutu, at a place called Berea. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about the episode. You can email me from there and also sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, tot ziens.